European leaders have pledged to turn the North Sea into a renewable power engine. They want to cut the use of fossil fuels and reliance on Russian gas. The plan is radical and costly, but will it work? And where will the money come from? This is Inside Story. And welcome to the programme. I'm Imran Khan. Finding new sources of green energy is no longer merely an aspiration for many governments, with the risks from climate change now felt all around the world. In Europe, the war in Ukraine has forced countries to seek alternatives to Russian gas. Harnessing sources which replenish themselves like wind and wave power is the aim of European leaders who want to turn the continent's northern seas into an engine of renewable energy. We'll discuss how realistic this is in a few moments with our guest. But first, Alexandra Byers reports on what northern European leaders have pledged at a summit in Belgium.
Resilience, sovereignty, made in Europe, but also meeting ambitious climate targets. Those were the aims of a summit in Belgium on Monday, where leaders from 9 European countries pledged to rapidly speed up the construction of offshore wind farms and dramatically change the balance of energy supplies in Europe.
This summit marks an important milestone. A milestone to make of the North Sea the biggest green power plant in the world. We aim for a capacity of 130 gigawatts by 2030, 300 gigawatts by 2050. By then, we will be able to provide electricity for 300 million households on the European continent.
The blocs promise to be carbon neutral by 2050. But after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, energy security has become a bigger priority. In the fallout of the war, Moscow cut its deliveries of energy supplies to Europe.
We have to make sure Putin no longer has the means to exert pressure on us by turning off the gas tap. And producing clean energy is the best way to achieve this. And the enormous potential of the North Sea region is indispensable here.
The leaders say they'll improve the security of the North Sea energy facilities too. Fears of attacks have grown after the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipelines last year and recent reports of a Russian spy ship in the North Sea region.
Our critical infrastructure is under threat. And we know it since we have experienced the sabotage of Nord Stream pipeline last year. So this is the reason why we have stepped up in the European Union our actions concerning preparedness.
The commitments made in Belgium will essentially quadruple the current offshore wind capacity in the North Sea. Leaders acknowledge it will take a huge investment. But they say for the security and sustainable future of Europe, it must be done. Alexandra Byers for Inside Story.
And let's bring in our guests now. In Stromness in the Orkney Islands, Scotland, Gareth Davis, founder of Aquaterra, an environmental and sustainable energy consultancy. His company is involved in the planning of future marine offshore renewables across Europe. In Brussels, Sandrine Dixon de Clerve, co-president of the Club of Rome, a climate policy advisory. Sandrine is also the EU ambassador of the Energy Transition Commission. And in London, Noah Brennan, Eastern Hemisphere editorial director for Energy Intelligence. Noah specialises in European oil and gas companies. A warm welcome to each of you. Before we get into the politics of this, let's get into the tech. And I want to begin in the Orkney Islands with Gareth Davis. Gareth, as far as I understand this, as a layperson, what effectively is going to happen is you're going to interconnect a bunch of wind farms and harness wave energy, and somehow that will replace Russia's gas for a whole continent. I mean, is that about the sum of it?
Unfortunately, it's a little more complicated than that. And I think that's the challenge, is that this isn't a simple solution. It is, in our view, an achievable solution, but it needs a lot of different parts put together. So what is really important is to have the policy or the strategy lead, if you like, and to understand that there's the political will to make these things happen. And then we need to then go to the next level down and get the strategy in place to deliver the investment and the infrastructure that's needed, and indeed that some of the technology advances that are going to make this possible. But there's a lot of progress that's been made in the last few decades, and you know, this is the right time probably to launch an initiative of this type.
But let's talk about that tech, Gareth. I mean, you say that the technology has come on in leaps and bounds over the last couple of decades, but it's not quite there yet. Is that what I'm understanding?
Well, what we've done really is made huge advances in wind and actually something that hasn't been mentioned yet this week, solar energy, but this could also be something that's part of the mix. But certainly offshore wind has, I think, exceeded everybody's expectations in terms of how much we've been able to deliver and at what price. What the next step entails is going into deeper waters and going to windier parts of the waters around Europe. So bringing the turbines up around Scotland and where we're based up in the islands off the north of Scotland, this is probably going to be the next focus. And in fact, there are now plans being prepared for 28 gigawatts of new offshore wind around Orkney, Shetland, and the Western Isles. And these turbines, as well as being the traditional founded turbines buried into the seabed, we're also looking at extensive floating turbines, which have started to be introduced, but the expansion of that is a major advance for the industry.
And now let me bring in Brussels here and Sandrine Dixon de Clerve. Sandrine, once again, this isn't about the environment. This isn't about climate change. This isn't about anything. This is about politics and Russia and the war in Ukraine affecting gas prices and gas supply. So it's once again politics that's driving something that actually we should have been doing a long time ago, right?
Well, I think it's a mix of everything, to be frank. I mean, yes, absolutely, the Ukrainian invasion has put actually the transition to renewables and energy efficiency, I hope, which is also part of the mix, by the way, and we can't forget that we have to think about consumption. All of this is being put on overdrive because we want to wean ourselves off Russian gas. And actually, over the last year, we've done phenomenally well in transitioning. The key here now is making sure that we scale it up to the level that it has to go. And that means actually increasing, for example, the wind turbine production capacity by 2 times by 2030. It means bottom fixed foundations capacity 4 times and installation vessel capacity 2 times. I mean, this is a lot of shift in particular, for example, in offshore wind. But as was indicated by the previous speaker, we also need to think about coupling that with investments across solar and then think through around energy efficiency. We know that clean electrification is the backbone of the transition to net zero. And we know that we need to radically, dramatically increase actually investments in wind and solar capacity by about 5 to 7 times by 2030. I think the key now is to think through, how do we get there? One, eliminate the perversities in the market that currently exist that don't enable us to actually invest and shift capital towards renewables infrastructure. Two, to make sure that we actually put in place the right funds, and we're starting to see that this is coming out of the European Union in terms of the temporary crisis and transition framework and the thinking through of the new EU sovereignty fund. And then three, very importantly, how do we ensure that actually people understand that this is a potential solution to energy poverty, that we start to show that renewable electrons can be at parity with gas prices, and that we don't actually induce even greater energy poverty across the European Union based on what we're actually seeing now?
I want to bring Noah Brenner in here. Noah, there is a danger here that if we're doing this because of Russia's actions in Ukraine to try and wean ourselves off Russian gas in Europe, then that's not the driver that needs to be, because Russia is not going to be in war in Ukraine for a long time. You know, at some point, the gas is going to come back on. There's Nord Stream 1, there's Nord Stream 2, which isn't back online yet. Effectively, Russian gas will be cheaper, and this is a massive investment. And there's a danger here. If we're doing it for money, not for the environment, it will simply just go away once Russian gas is cheaper and we're all friends again.
Well, I mean, I think I would be a little bit careful about thinking that that Russian gas is simply going to return, even should we see some sort of pause or some potential long-term resolution with the Ukraine conflict. I mean, the companies that we talk to, the traders that we talk to, all of them have a pretty cautious view. And then I would say the diplomats that we talk to as well have a pretty cautious view, a pretty pessimistic view that Europe really ever returns to Russian gas. I mean, this is both from a, you know, if you think of it from a geopolitical perspective, but I mean, also simply from a security of supply perspective. This is an energy source that has kind of been choked and throttled at very strategic times to create some of the really the highest gas and power prices that the European continent has seen. And so I think, you know, what does make this much more likely to move ahead? I mean, what gives the impetus and the urgency is simply that it is not simply an environmental push that's driving this forward. It is an energy security push. And for a continent like Europe that really doesn't have a lot of domestic resource potential when it comes to especially oil and gas, of course, this is what energy security looks like.
Gareth, clearly the momentum is now on the side of this. People do want to get this going, but it's going to cost billions in investment. It's going to require a buy-in from the energy companies. The energy companies already said, we don't have the money for the infrastructure here. Where is that money going to come from?
Well, in the end, all of our energy system money comes from us, the customers that pay for that energy. The question is about investment and how much upfront investment happens rather than things getting drip fed into the system. And we've been doing some analysis which looks at how much we spend as a society at the moment, year on year, on energy, and then compare it with the kind of investments that we're looking at. And from our calculations, it suggests that in Europe at the moment, we're probably spending around £500 billion a year across Europe on our energy sources. And the investment that we're talking about, say for 300 gigawatts of energy, would perhaps be around 600 billion to £1 trillion. So effectively what we're saying is each year we spend about 50% of what we actually need to make that kind of investment. So over the next 20 years, which is, you know, we've got 20 years to do this, you know, if effectively we have the time to make the investment from the cost that we're already incurring for our energy system. What has to happen is instead of us paying that money into the existing oil and gas and to a certain extent coal pathways, we need to redirect that revenue into renewables. And that's what the carbon transition is all about.
Sandrine, that's an eye-watering figure, $500 billion to $1 trillion in investment just to get this up and running. Gas is always going to be cheaper. At some point, there's going to be a wobble, surely. People aren't going to want to spend this money.
But this is exactly what I'm saying. I mean, I think that we need to bring back into consideration the fact that actually gas is increasingly going to be costly, that we can't continue to move down that route, that we have to take perversities out of the market to enable actually those renewable electrons to be cheaper. Yes, we are investing, but a lot of that capital is shifting from investors that are de-risking and seeing that actually renewables are the way forward and are actually the type of energy that we want to think about. I mean, in the current international context, if you look at energy security and the work that I'm also doing on the board of EDP, which is the electricity company for Portugal, it's very clear that they have diversified. They're pulling out of coal. In fact, they will be out of coal already by 2025 and fully green by 2030. There are many companies, electricity companies across Europe that are doing the same thing. They've put in place just transition plans to come out of coal plants and actually have already done so, for example, in EDP's case and Sines. And what they're thinking is that the investment makes sense in floating offshore wind energy, the way in which they're addressing renewables in a variety of different countries, including in the United States, in Latin America and elsewhere. So this is also creating a competitive European industry, not only in terms of electricity companies themselves, but through the full supply chain and industry opportunities. I mean, besides actually delivering the clean energy Offshore wind energy impact is the creation of new supply chain opportunities, also in the area of solar. And this is helping industrial companies, it's creating new jobs, and it's exactly what President von der Leyen has been calling for through the new Green Deal. So I think this is the industrial and the energy revolution that's really going to transform Europe. We have to stay ahead of the game. Otherwise, we're going to lose out to China and to the United States, who's put in place, actually, the Inflation Reduction Act and is moving very quickly in this direction.
Noah, where does this leave the traditional oil and gas companies? They must be looking at this tech and they must be worried.
Well, I mean, for the European majors, the companies like a BP, a Total Energies, a Shell, this particularly offshore wind, but renewable power in general is a major pillar of their energy transition strategy. This is different from their U.S. peers, but I mean, this offshore wind is an area where these companies feel that they can bring competitive advantage around management of supply chain, engineering, working in these complex offshore environments. But, I think it's also really important, as we point out, that this is an industry that, has opportunities globally, whether it's in the U.S., where they do have the Inflation Reduction Act, or in parts of Latin America. There's an opportunity set there that they can choose where the best returns are. They can try to understand where the best regulatory environments are, where there are incentives, where there is financial capacity to be able to partner, whether it's with, financial firms or with governments. And so I think the idea that Europe really needs to get this right to be able to attract the amount of investment, attract the expertise, the capacity that it needs to realize these very, very ambitious plans is critical. Simply saying that this is the goal that we have, and then, finding ways to incentivize it and to realize it in a way that's cost effective and comes through on time and on budget. It's a very, very difficult undertaking. I don't think we should kid ourselves that getting this right is both important and will be a challenge.
Gareth, that's an important word, isn't it? Ambitious. We keep hearing that a lot. I just want to give you an example. 20 years ago, it felt like that we were talking about solar energy being the future, solar energy being something that was going to radically change everything. Yet here we are 20 years later, we're still relying on fossil fuels, we're still relying on electricity, and that hasn't quite materialized in the way that it should. Why will this?
It's a number of factors. I think, we have to recognize that the incumbent forces in our political and economic systems have been, to the fore in the last 20 years, and that's held back the deployment of technology. But as one of the other contributors said, the facts now are that wind and indeed even offshore wind, as well as solar, are actually going to be our cheapest energy sources going forward. And that's to address your question about Russian gas. It's very unlikely that Russian gas will ever reach prices that actually undercut where renewables are going to get to in the next few years. So renewables will be our cheapest form of energy. It is a question then of mobilizing the supply chains and creating the infrastructure to take that forward. And there are particular countries, particular communities that have been incredibly ambitious to get involved in that. And I think, the Orkney Islands, where I'm speaking to you from, are exactly one of those places where, as a small community, we've embraced the opportunities that renewables can create. And we've now got 400 people, we've got 20 or so companies in our small community that are focused on renewables. And those companies are really interested now in getting involved in this huge revolution that we're talking about with regards to offshore wind and helping deliver it at an affordable price and in an accelerated way, where we use the learning that we've established over the last 20 years or so.
Now, Sandrine, we are talking about the North Sea now. That is a big, significant challenge. That's got to give you pause, surely.
Yeah, no, clearly it is a challenge, but I think that there are many countries that are ready for that challenge. And if you look at the Ostend Declaration, for example, that is looking at the North Sea challenge in particular, those are the countries of Belgium, Denmark, Germany, the Netherlands, France and Ireland, Luxembourg, Norway, and the United Kingdom have all wanted to already start to invest very clearly in offshore wind. I think the key here, though, is that in some ways we're saying that offshore wind farms can get to commercial scale in Europe by 3 years. But in many cases, we're seeing that there is a real problem in terms of lag times on permitting. So coming back to how do we scale this up? How do we really start to ensure that we get the infrastructure where it needs to be and the transmission lines as well? I mean, let's not speak about some of the politics that we're seeing across different countries. But if we continue to bring those time lags down, then we will see that the development of the projects can go much faster. And I'm a bit worried about these time lags. And actually, this is a large-scale report that was undertaken by ETC, the Energy Transition Commission, in which we're speaking about now to officials to say that we absolutely have to reduce permitting times and that construction really can take 2 to 3 years. But these permitting times of up to 10 to 12 years is going to kill the industry if it continues that way. We also need to think through, however, how we can continue to be very firm and vigilant around environmental impact assessments, but by the same token, enable some of these projects to get through, making sure that we are still preserving our biodiversity and our pollution laws the way in which we should. So it's finding that balancing act, but it's also making the scale ready now and thinking through the permitting. If we compare to the United States, where the permitting times are so much swifter, we're going to lose out if we don't start to think about this very clearly.
Noah, Sandrine makes a point I wanted to ask you about, which is one of permitting, which is one of getting all of these countries together and making sure that they're in lockstep and effectively actually starting to build this technology. Now, Europe doesn't have a great track record when it comes to doing this.
No, and I mean, the permitting issue is huge. I think if you talk to companies that are trying to advance these types of projects globally, what they come back to time and again is permitting. How quickly can they get from an idea and getting the license that they need to moving through all the approvals? And let's be honest, I mean, these are, sure, from a climate perspective, wind installations, renewable power installations are great. But we are seeing, whether it's here in the UK, whether it's in the US, other places in Europe, pushback against putting these are industrial scale power facilities, putting these in places. And I think this is one reason why it has to be offshore wind. I mean, why, you know, the head of BP's gas and renewables division was saying, you know, offshore wind it has to go offshore. There just simply isn't enough land for it. But I mean, there are still going to be constituencies and trade-offs to balance out there, whether it's fishing industries, whether it's environmental. And I think how politicians navigate that balance and how they find a way to move ahead with these projects in a way that, you know, time is money. And if they aren't moved forward in a way that that preserves that rate of return for companies, it's not going to work. And I think the same thing can be just said about industrial capacity. I mean, building in the North Sea is difficult, but the oil and gas industry has been doing it for years. But we've also seen that when everybody tries to do the same thing in the same place at the same time, that the cost of labor, the cost of materials, the cost to build things goes up, and it can go up quite rapidly. And that can erode your rate of return as well. And so, you know, I think that these are two very difficult challenges. They certainly can be solved. But, you know, those are two things that I would be keeping an eye on in terms of how much of this this goal actually gets delivered.
Well, we're lucky enough to be joined by someone who is from one of the companies that might be involved in doing this. Gareth Davis, you run Aquaterra, an environmental and sustainable energy consultancy. There is an awful lot of red tape to get through. Europe isn't great at red tape. Could this scupper your big, ambitious plans?
Well, I think we're all engaged in a plan that actually it's not any one person's plan. The world needs decarbonized energy. I mean, that's a fact. It's well established. It's our biggest priority. And so getting people behind that is absolutely important. I think one nuance I would make is that, you know, the headline discussion is about that we're going to do this in the North Sea. The reality is that the best wind resources in Europe are at the northern end of the North Sea and to the west of Scotland and Ireland. And it would be very surprising if this focus on productivity didn't take the developments to those places. And I think in doing so, that will avoid some of the more acute planning challenges which exist, because the North Sea is the busiest and the most heavily used and has some of the most valued natural communities. And so there might be a little bit more space in some of these more northern and western areas for these developments to take place. But the appropriate planning and choosing the right places for these wind farms and other forms of technology will be absolutely critical. And as will the fact that we need to spread them out across the north-south line, if you like, of Europe, because our weather systems go east-west. Generally,
sorry, Gareth, we are running out of time. And I do want to come quickly to Sandrine. Sandrine, we've talked a lot about the politics, we've talked about the finance, we've talked about the tech. Are you talking to environmentalists and scientists about this? Are there any concerns here from those lobbies?
Listen, I think that clearly environmentalists, exactly as was just said, all believe, we all feel that it is time now to put in place a proper net zero carbon plan, to move towards renewable energy. Where we need to be cognizant is, first of all, how can we scale up existing technology and not just think about breakthrough technologies? So how can we think through what we have now to scale it up? Secondly, what many environmentalists are saying is, please, let's not forget, and I say the same, demand side management. Let's not just focus on what's bright and what we think is new, and instead look at consumption. We can do a huge amount if we reduce our consumption of energy. And then the last point, and I do think this is something that we're all thinking about, and that is, what will be our material dependencies? We absolutely have to reduce the use of fossil energy to zero. We know that that's absolutely fundamental, but we also need to think through our dependencies and our substitution towards material use and rare earths. And I think that is one key concern that comes up, but that doesn't mean that we should not pull out of fossil energy. I think environmentalists across the globe are very clear, as are analysts and scientists, that we have to focus primarily on weaning ourselves off fossil energy, and that must be done now.
I want to thank all our guests, Gareth Davis, Sandrine Dixon-Declerve, and Noah Brennan. And I want to thank you two for watching as well. Now, you can see the programme again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And you can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Imran Khan, and the entire team here, bye for now.